Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, August 13th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's episode, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible by pledging your support through patreon.com/talknerdy. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And because of the top supporters, people like yourselves, people whose names I'm about to shout out, you make it so that other people can enjoy the show for free forever. I don't want to say forever. That's a big promise. I mean, you know, one day I'm not going to be able to do this anymore. But let's say for the foreseeable future, it will always, always remain free, though. That is something I can promise. And I couldn't do it without Definitely couldn't do it without Rob Schreck. Rob, thank you so very much. You are the top supporter on the show by a long shot. And I know from our interactions on social media that you're going through an awful lot right now. And it's really meaningful to me that you contribute to the show, that it's something that matters to you in your life right now. It really does mean an awful lot. So thank you, like, deeply, dearly, from the bottom of my heart. I also want to thank Phil T-Bear, the zombie drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but certainly not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so very much. All right. You want to dive into this episode? I think I want to dive into this episode. This week, I have a chat, a really interesting chat with Dr. Siva Kumari. She's the Director General of the International Baccalaureate. And if you've never heard of International Baccalaureate or IB, you're going to learn a lot. I was an IB student, I should say, when I was in high school. It meant a lot to my educational. And I think it's really cool that I had a chance to talk to Dr. Kumari and to talk about what IB is, what it means, and how it's improving education across the globe. So guys, without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Siva Kumari. Siva, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, not a problem, Kara. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. So we are going to be speaking about International Baccalaureate. You're actually the Director General, the seventh Director General of IB, and you are the first woman to be the Director General of IB. I have to say this is near and dear to my heart because I was an IB student when I was in high school.
Oh, that's great. Yes, I knew that.
So I actually didn't end up, I don't know, quote unquote, graduating IB because my senior year of high school, I started at university instead. So I did IB for 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. I didn't technically go to 12th grade. And at my school, that was the International Baccalaureate program. It was a high school program, or I should say at my series of schools where I grew up in Plano, Texas, a suburb of Dallas. But that said, the more that I've dug into the background of IB, the more I've realized that it is much more than a sort of honors or gifted or college preparatory program for high school students. So let's talk about anything and everything International Baccalaureate. Maybe a good top line to start for anybody who has never even heard these words before. What is IB?
Great. That's a good question because some people ask me if it's a language program.
Yes.
So the IB is, as you said, the International Baccalaureate. It was started 50 years ago by a group of educators who were very concerned about the wars and peace being an important part of education. So they wanted to create a different kind of education where the children really learn about each other's cultures and each other's countries and global issues, etc. And it is more, you know, they wanted to create something that is more than rote memorization, which was the state of education at that time. So educators from America, you know, UK, France, Germany, etc., mostly the Western traditions got together and created, you know, this thing as an experiment, really. And they found a few schools that will adopt it and test it out as a curriculum. And, you know, 50 years on, it's become known as one of the gold standards of education. I mean, we don't call it that, but others call it that. 50 years ago, what these educators started was a pre-university program, essentially, which is called a diploma. So it's a two-year study before one enters university or the world of work, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that was our signature program. And it's kind of like liberal arts education before university. They believed that specialization should come later and that the child or student should be exposed to all kinds of disciplines. And, you know, arts and history and humanities and sciences and mathematics and study of languages, but study of more than one language so one could understand, you know, how other cultures think and what are the ways of knowing, etc. But what really got me to like the IB, because I came to the IB through my research, was that it had something called the core. And the core consisted of three pieces. One was called the theory of knowledge. One was called the creativity, action, and service. And the third component is an extended essay. And this is what really drew me, because I hadn't seen this in many pre-university programs. The extended essay is a 4,000-piece essay of deep research that a student writes. But Theory of Knowledge, my favorite course, because it allows exploration of topics and understanding, you know, how people come to know what they know, why they believe what they believe, what their backgrounds are, how scientists believe, how humanity or social scientists come to study subjects, and all of that. So it's quite an epistemology sort of course, which I think is quite unique at the pre-university level. And even writing a 4,000-piece essay, which I thought was quite extraordinary, because I didn't write essays like that till I entered my master's program.
Absolutely. Like you said, pre-university, I mean, even at the university level, unless you're actively studying philosophy, you probably don't have exposure to different epistemologies or even the concept of epistemology.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really what fascinated me about it, Kara, to see that, you know, this was all kind of wanted and required. These educators 50 years ago thought this is a really good way to engage students. It's not about getting them into universities. It's creating our next wave of humanity, right? And creating our next wave of leaders. And that still stands today. So I think I'm really pleased to be a part of it and be given this position to lead it.
And so for a student, for example, who participates in the diploma program, and again, we'll talk about it, but there are more opportunities now than just the diploma program. I was aware of the diploma program because that's what I was participating in at my high school. But for the students who participate in the diploma program, there are, as you mentioned, these different core elements. There are different assessments, different exams, different curriculum that is necessary. And what do they kind of get to walk away from if they've gone through this program? What do they get to walk away with?
Well, I think, as you said, you know, it's all of those components. So a student can fulfill the entire diploma, which is all of those, you know, courses in these areas that I talked about, you know, languages and humanities and sciences, and complete the core. They walk away with what is called a diploma, the IB diploma, and only we award it. But one of the, you know, wonderful things about it is universities around the world know it and accept it and look forward to these students because they know they're well prepared. You know, and because of this kind of preparation, these students, they ask a lot of questions when they enter university. They're able to write, so they're not intimidated by those first year, two years of university, because it's not just the essay, but we also, the assessment that we do is very rich, you know, so it's not multiple choice questions or anything like that. So the students are continually thinking and writing, so because there's no right answer, so they have to come up with their own version of thinking about a prompt or a question that we give. So they walk away with what's called this diploma, and I'm really pleased to report that now around the world this diploma is accepted. And many countries give us equivalency, i.e. you can do a high school curriculum or you can do a diploma and it'll be considered high school equivalency in many countries.
Oh, that's really neat. And also, I know that at least at my local universities, if a student finished the IB program and, you know, made all of the milestones and earned that diploma, in many ways, it was equivalent to advanced placement. Oftentimes, we would take the advanced placement exams as part of the IB class. And we would end up with a lot of college credit kind of under our belt by the time we graduated as high school graduates.
That is true. I also studied the AP program and was familiar with it before I actually came to know about the IB program because I was in a university before. So it's really interesting because in the United States, as compared to other countries, universities give this credit. You know, you can, some of the students get advanced standing. They get like, sophomore level already. Mm-hmm. Or they are allowed to take, which is quite a savings in some universities. I know, for instance, that the University of Texas gives them the first year off, and you can imagine the amount of monetary savings that is.
Absolutely.
But more importantly, I think, you may have felt this as well after you did your advanced courses, is you're able to move into a higher level of course in the university. You know, so you're able to retain your level of curiosity and, academics, if you so wish, which is really nice. I think for all the hard work, it pays off.
Oh, absolutely. Because that is a struggle, I think, for some students if they are achieving at a very high level at, you know, a high school that really respects this kind of discourse. And then they start at a university and have to take maybe these remedial level courses, and they may lose interest very quickly.
That's true. I mean, we do talk to the students about it. I talk to students who've completed the diploma and are now in their professions, etc. Obviously, we've been doing this for 50 years, so there are a lot of those, you know, and they say this is the most rigorous education they've gone through in their life. Mm-hmm. And everything after it is doable. You know, they feel they can succeed at anything. So that's a really nice preparation as well.
Absolutely. And of course, students who have gone through the International Baccalaureate from all over the world have held positions in, I mean, basically every field you can imagine, because as you said, this is kind of more of a global training. It's not a specialty. So you've got scientists and diplomats and musicians, and it really runs the gamut.
Yeah, absolutely. We, you know, anything we want, I think we've found IB alumni do. But I also want to make the point that, you know, so, you know, we are in the United States, our footprint in the schools is mostly in public schools. So I don't want to leave the impression that this is for only highly academically able students. We found, I mean, there's research that's been done where we found that when students from, say, low socioeconomic conditions, in Chicago Public Schools, for instance, when we did this study, well, not we, somebody else did the study, they found that students taking even one or two IB classes really felt very good about studying, you see, about the way the subject connects to global issues, etc. And their aspirations went up and they did very well in college after, you know. So I think it is, you know, in my view, I don't know how you feel about these things, but it is, if you give students really engaging learning experiences and set the standard, they will rise to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if you look at my particular, which is anecdotal, but my particular case, I was struggling a bit in high school socially and even academically, just in terms of not being as challenged as I would have liked. And so I did pre-IB in ninth and 10th grade at my university, or I keep saying university, at my public high school, by the way, I did go to public school. They offered something called pre-IB. So it was like getting ready for your IB courses. And then I completed my junior year of high school in a full IB load. That was my plan, was to graduate with and get the International Baccalaureate diploma. But again, my senior year, we petitioned to my high school and they allowed me to go to community college for my, I only had something like 3 credits necessary to graduate based on curriculum standards. So they allowed me to go to community college. So I didn't get the International Baccalaureate diploma, but it didn't matter fully because I was so prepared when I started university a year early. And I was ready for it. I actually had the same problem that we mentioned previously, which is that some of those freshman level or even sophomore level, because I had clept out of a few of them, courses were not that challenging for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing because, you know, the one thing, you know, that we prepare these students for is, you know, to really be able to critically think. You know, I hope you felt that when you were going through your classes.
Absolutely.
Because they're not being assessed. You know, of course, we have the teacher is able to assess some and we take the marks that the teacher gives. But the rest of the examinations are conducted internationally. So you don't know who your examiner is going to be. You know, so you have to be able to write towards an international standard, et cetera. And that's really, really good preparation for these days, I think, you know, because students, you know, wherever we work, we're going to be global. I mean, I grew up in a small town in India and my job is now completely global. And, you know, even if you work, you know, in some place in the US, you're still going to be interacting with globally or you're going to feel the global trends. You know, so I think this kind of preparation where you have to think of global issues, you have to think about how to, you know, process information from a variety of sources. All of these, I think, are good things, you know, as we move into what's now being called the fourth industrial revolution, right? We're moving away from what we were calling 21st century skills, et cetera.
Completely. And the interesting thing is that, as you mentioned, the IB started 50 years ago, so this was definitely pre-internet, but had this strong, always had, it was founded on this very strong global perspective. And it's so, I can only imagine how many more challenges there were back then, just logistically, to make sure that everybody was on the same page and to make sure that the standards were being kept up. Because you couldn't just do what we're doing right now and dial in and say hello from right now. We're across the country, but I do it all the time on the show with people across the globe.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I mean, it's pretty amazing because, you know, it's our 50th year. So we're picking up bits and bites of, you know, history. And what's amazing to me is till a few years ago, roughly till about 10 years ago, for instance, the IB would mail these, you know, scripts around the world. And then the schools would send these paper copies of students' work to, you know, some examiner we would tell them to send it to. And it was by pure luck that all of these came back. You know, we would get all of these. So it's only now that we're doing this electronically where we say we still send the students still write on paper. Unfortunately, we're moving away. We're working on it. But at the moment, students still write on paper, but they send it to a local scanning center. And, you know, the scanning center then gives us the exams. But, you know, if you think about how this thing was pulled off for 50 years with, you know, the kind of fax communications and telephone communications that happened, it's pretty amazing, you know, because it's the only educational services company that I know, you know, and a not-for-profit at that, that started globally and kept growing globally.
And when you say globally, you really mean globally. And, you know, talking about doing these paper and pencil mailings, when you said it's kind of amazing that they actually came back, that's because IB is in places where the infrastructure is not as maybe maintained as other places. Like, this is not just for, as you said, kind of rich, high SES, Western academic standards. IB is all over the world.
We are. We're in 150 countries. And, you know, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I go around to many of these schools around the world. I feel extraordinarily, you know, fortunate to have this experience. And you're right. You know, at this moment, it started off that way. In the beginning, it was, you know, about, it was based in international schools. But at the moment, it's not. We have schools, you know, in Ecuador, you know, in many, many, you know, parts of Ecuador where there isn't a lot of money. We have schools in Chicago, as I said. We have schools in Japan. We have schools in parts of Africa where there are these entrepreneurs trying to bring IB to really low-cost settings. So it is really all over the world at the moment.
That's so neat.
Yes, it really is. And I think, you know, what binds the IB community is this inspirational thinking, right? That we're, you know, humanity's problems are common, even though we're separated by borders.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, children who are prepared to think about how to solve problems locally and globally are really idealistically connected. And I think the other part for me, because I've been reading a lot about teachers, it's my job to keep up with what's happening in the world, you know, so it's really interesting for me how many of our educational systems are really taking out the inspiration from teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think what I focus on, and an extraordinary number of my colleagues focus on, is how to put the inspiration back in teaching, how to trust the teacher. Because at the end of the day, it's that teacher that ignites the learning in the classroom.
Oh, completely. And when things become, I don't know, too manualized, when they become too rigid, that's true, it can take some of that X factor away, you know, that really is what makes the students inspired. I think it's interesting that you talk about this global perspective, because so much of the global perspective is about multiculturalism. And I know we say this all the time, that now more than ever, or especially in the American political environment, or, you know, however you want to word it, but I think that this is not just a uniquely American problem. We're facing this in the West as well, all over the West, that there is a strong, entrenched, tribalistic kind of movement that's taking place right now. And educating people when they're very young that they are not the only people in the world, and that there are others who are very much like them and who are very different from them, who they can learn from, I think is fundamental to being a well-rounded human being and to putting an early stop to, you know, xenophobia and to racism and to some of these entrenched issues that are just really, really pernicious.
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, children are the next wave, right? I think what we need to prepare them is to understand that we all come in different shapes and different colors, but the mind is the mind. And access to education is the one way to erase all of these kind of negative things. They'll always be in the world. I mean, we've lived through centuries now, and we know this is going to go on. I think the best we can do is to prepare students to be excited about learning, excited about other cultures, and to know, you know. And I think in that sense, Kara, as you know, these technologies are becoming amazing, right? I'm looking forward to the day where I can speak to a Japanese person without a translator, right? Because of all the things, the voice technologies and the voice translation and all of that that are happening. And those will be here before we know it. You know, like you said, we're speaking across a computer, and right, there's a connection, right? Still, you know, so I think, you know, that so for me, I think the way to prepare these students is to just, you know, be focused that water is water wherever it is, whether it's flowing down the Nile in Egypt or it's flowing down, you know, the Mississippi. And the microbes and all of that are different, but the study of them, the science of them is the same.
Absolutely. And of course, as you mentioned, you grew up in India. You even did your undergraduate degree in India. But then you've worked very close to where I grew up, in Texas. That's a big change.
Yeah, I'm speaking to you now from Houston. I'm here in Texas.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, this is not just kind of a coastal, you know, I think you're right. It's important to correct any misperceptions, because a lot of times when we talk about sort of advanced or high achievement or standards, global standards that we think of as higher than the minimum standards of maybe a nation's educational system, a lot of people might equate that with privilege, but this is not kind of a coastal elite initiative. And also, it's not something where the children bear the financial burden.
No, not in this country. No, it's really in public schools, which I really admire. And more around the world, we're able to do that too. But I think, you know, for us, it is great to see this curriculum embedded among so many other things, right? Like even in Texas, you have the TEKS here, and then in the rest of the world, you know, in rest of America, you have Common Core and all of that. Or in Massachusetts, you have the Massachusetts standards. So that people are able to put the IB in place and still want the IB, to me, really shows that there are some schools that want that well-rounded child, you know, because it's not just about globalism, but it's also about creating that child that is very well prepared. And as you know, more and more these days, you know, all of the sciences. The exciting part is happening in sciences where there's an intersect between disciplines. You know, I'm fascinated by nanotechnology and, you know, and all of these other these developments now with AI, et cetera, the 3D printing and biotechnology, which are really combinations of disciplines. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think this preparation, what I find really exciting about the IB is the more I think about it and the more I think, well, what's coming next and well, are we still relevant? It somehow remains relevant because those tenets of interdisciplinary, which were, you know, 50 years ago, these people thought of, are still very valid today. You know, that discipline is not cut off by you study biology and you study mathematics separately and the twain shall never meet. It's to try and see the connections across disciplines as well, which is an important part of what we do.
And it's so neat to see that many university settings are starting to move towards a curriculum model. I mean, they've always had core curriculum and required courses across disciplines in order to get an undergraduate degree. But it's really cool that I'm hearing more and more about people who get to quote unquote make their own degree, where their specialty is kind of whatever they want it to be because it is multidisciplinary.
Yeah, I mean, my daughter studied here, you know, at Rice University here in Houston, and she created a major for herself, which was between civil engineering and international relations.
Oh, cool. I mean,
two really don't seem to have anything together, but that's, you know, that's her breadth of her interests, and she was able to do that. And I think now it's becoming more and more common for students to do that. And I think that is great because that expands your mind. It fires up more neurons. It makes you more, you know, when you go into the workplace, you're more, you know, different in your thinking. You're not boxed in, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, so many people, I think, within my generation and younger, I'm sort of at that intersection between what would you call me, Gen X and millennial. I'm 34 years old. And so many people my age and younger are not, they're not facing, maybe facing is the wrong word, they're not able to go the traditional route the way that our boomer parents were able to do. It's no longer, I think, the standard that somebody leaves high school or maybe leaves their undergraduate degree, goes into industry and works for the same company for 40 years before they retire and get a gold watch. It's just people are doing more freelance work. They are juggling multiple jobs. They are consulting. They're forging their own path in kind of a less traditional way. And to be nimble in this kind of a workforce, yeah, you have to have specialized skills.
I agree. You know, I think I read somewhere, maybe McKinsey put this out, that, you know, a person of your age will have 7 jobs right before you retire, if ever.
If ever. And we do these, it's not just 7, you know, discrete jobs, but sometimes we do these massive career shifts. You know, I'm 35 and I'm just now going back to school to get my PhD. I took 10-year break between my master's degree. And I, you know, I worked on a PhD for a year and left at the time. It just wasn't the right time. But I took a 10-year break and now I'm back in school doing a massive career shift into another field. And I don't think that's terribly uncommon for people my age.
No, I think that's great. I mean, I got to where I am through quite a lot of zigzags. I didn't have a traditional straight shoot through one kind of subject or, you know, just because of my life circumstances, I was married, I was following my husband. So, you know, I had to do that. And then my interest changed and then I was doing something else. But I was reading somewhere, Kara, that students who now actually this is from the World Economic Forum I was reading, that the students who now enter the bachelor's programs, right, by the time they graduate, 50% of the content they studied there is outdated.
Oh my goodness. It just in the 4 years that they spent at school.
Yeah. So,
oh my God.
So I think, you know, we now know more than ever that content is not king, you know. So the thing is that how do you quickly in your own brain use, reuse content, forget, learn how to relearn, right? Be able to go to deep dive some places and just maintain balance in all of this information we get, right? That's something also.
That's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about yourself, you know, I think it's really good that you made these changes because your mind can, you know, flex in so many ways, right? Mm-hmm. It's built in a kind of like a complex set of ways just because of the different disciplines you may have gathered and the different life experiences you have gathered, which is really what we need, right? There's no, you know, with so much information coming and AI coming into the scene, when we know robots are going to be programmed to think and can possibly think better than that, better than us, or go deeper into certain areas better than us, I think you have to become a different sort of individual to adapt to these things. You know, just as you said, no more gold watch, no more I'll stay in this company forever and give my life to this company. You know, mm-hmm. so I think you have to think of yourself as this individual, this learning machine, but not just the learning machine, but also the doing machine, and also the, you know, person who is able to maintain your balance in all of this, because that's hard. Shifting is hard and moving is hard. Learning and unlearning is hard.
Oh, completely. And I think it's so important that you mentioned the doing machine, because I do think that there has been a shift. Many educational programs have been slower to keep up with that shift, but I do think there has been this shift away from just, as you said, content being king, because we have the internet at our disposal. We no longer have to, you know, I think there's base level information that's important to be nimble and to be adaptive. But at a certain point, we can look things up, and what's necessary and appropriate is that we know how to look things up, and that we have a baloney detector, and that we're capable of keeping up with the literature, and that we're capable of doing, you know, like in the lab sciences, the laboratory component is so central, because just knowing facts, for example, is not science. Science is doing the procedures. And that's just so fundamental to how we have to learn today. It's not just about knowing stuff. We can kind of look stuff up and we can look up how that stuff has changed, but it's about knowing how to look that stuff up and knowing how to work with that stuff that's in our minds to draw inferences and conclusions.
Yeah, but also asking the questions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, asking the different kind of questions, as you're saying, you know, and so when you're doing that experiment, you know, not just following someone else's procedure, but trying to think through what, you know, what else can I study? What else am I missing, et cetera, which is, you know, all of the new data scientists and all. I like how they ask completely different questions based on the data they're getting rather than starting with a question and getting the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. You know, so all of this requires children to think, I think. And therefore, we try to prepare them for that as well, so that they're really unafraid to ask questions, because some of the systems that we see actually don't want the child to ask the questions. And I think that's not right. I think we need our children to be asking the questions, because after all, you know, that's how their mind stays engaged, right? These are not robots we're programming.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Blue Apron. I talk about them all the time on the show because they are so good. They deliver farm fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door in an effort to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. I love Blue Apron because the recipes are quick and easy. I do not proclaim to be a good chef, but they make it really easy. The ingredients are perfectly portioned. The dinner is quick. It's super tasty. And you don't have to think about what you're going to eat. You can skip meal planning and get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. And of course, there are chef-designed recipes and exciting partnerships like Bob's Burgers and MasterChef. Yes, Bob's Burgers and MasterChef. So what is cooking up this month? How about cheeseburgers with spicy slaw or seared chicken and tangy barbecue sauce? Yum, yum. So guys, I don't know what you're waiting for. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free at blueapron.com/nerdy. That's blueapron.com/nerdy to get your first three meals free. Ready to become a leader? Enroll in Army ROTC. You could get a full tuition scholarship, and you'll graduate a leader and an officer in the U.S. Army. Army officers inspire strength in others. To receive more information about the Army ROTC program, visit goarmy.com/podcast today. Paid for by the United States Army. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I think you're right. The two things that I think are the biggest failures that I sometimes will see in some educational perspectives or systems are A, the kind of stunting of that questioning mentality, and B, the expectation that students shouldn't fail, which I think is really detrimental. I think that part of learning is failing.
Yeah. The thing you mentioned earlier is that we are not, you know, over the course of the 50 years, we've moved from just being the diploma program to going all the way to, we start at year three now, the age of the child.
Oh, wow.
So, and in that we have a program called the Primary Years Program, in which we encourage the children to do their own project, you know. So that program ends at 11 years, so roughly fifth grade in the U.S. And I think we ask them to keep asking questions. In fact, parents of these children, this primary year program, you know, when I talk to them, they say, well, our child just suddenly starts asking all of these questions, and then at some point I have to tell them the dinner table is full. And then we just have to say, I don't know the answer. And I feel, you know, the parents say they feel bad, and we say, well, there's no need for you to feel bad, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Look it up together.
Yeah, exactly. But we ask these children to do what is called an exhibition, where we ask them to take something that they want to change, you know, in the world, and or study in the world, you know, and own it, you see. So they have to do their own research, and it's not as rigorous as our diploma research, but they have to do their own research, and they have to present their project to, you know, the peers, you know, the fellow students, you know, students' parents, whoever the school invites. So these are little bitty human beings who are talking to adults, et cetera, and talking about their subject, which is what we want. We want these children to own their learning, to know it's their learning, and to be able to speak up.
And so you have this primary years program, and then there's also a program that sort of bridges those early years to the sort of senior high school level diploma program.
Correct. It's called our middle years program. So all of these are designed, Kara, to ensure that we understand what is happening with the brain development of the child, and with the mentality of the child. So, for instance, we know in the primary year age set, children are curious. They shouldn't necessarily be taught about disciplines. They should be taught about curiosity of the world. So, you know, where are you from? How does the world work? Those are the kind of themes we encourage in that area. In the middle years program, we know the child is restless and needs to be engaged, etc. So we designed the program for that. And it's still situated in global contexts. And in this particular area, we ask the child to do something called the personal project, which goes a little bit deeper into the child doing research and producing something tangible. I mean, I adore going to these, they're called exhibitions, these personal project exhibitions that I attended, and I've attended some around the world. I remember being in the school in India, and this child had designed as part of this personal project, this little device that you put, you know, you've heard of rickshaws in India, little, you know, tricycles that people carry passengers on. Mm-hmm. There are thousands and thousands of these things. And obviously these, you know, that people who drive these rickshaws, the rickshaw drivers are very poor. So this child designed the little device, which is to power the battery based on, so the rickshaw person could put it on his tires. They're mostly men, so on his tires. And, you know, it would power during his day. So as he was delivering passengers, et cetera, it would power. And then he could take that and go put it in his home. So his child could, you know, they could have light in their, you know, dwelling hut or wherever they were living. So their children could study at night, you know.
Incredible.
Incredible, right? I mean, I think that the whole point of this is that you ask children to think, you ask them to do, they will, you know, they will rise up to the challenge. They will do more than you expect, and they will be so engaged. So I think that's our middle year program.
Oh, and it's so cool because that mind of the child too will sometimes come up with the most simple and effective solutions to problems that are outside of the kind of standard way that we're used to thinking. And so something like that, where obviously the technology exists, obviously this is not, you know, a massive leap, but maybe nobody even thought to connect the technology to the need.
Yeah.
That's the important part, right? Is that human component.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we're thinking of ideas of social entrepreneurship now as part of the curriculum. We haven't finalized them, but we're thinking about them. And I think that's what's going to be the next the generations of these IB children will be thinking, because it was a young lady actually who made that battery device thing that she was cooking up. Mm-hmm. You know, you can imagine, I mean, she could easily create a business out of that. Right.
Oh, definitely.
You think of the thousands of rickshaw drivers that are around the city where she was living in, and to power those up, and that could become something she gives the world, really, you know, quite freely. I mean, you remember when you were at that age, I was at that age, I was quite concerned about people and what's going on in the world and all of that. And I think if we can channel the children to think about those instead of, you know, Facebook and whatever else. I think they can do it. And I think that's why these programs stay alive, because they're encouraging that. And for the teacher also, it's engaging, because it's very inspirational to see your students to do all these kind of things, you see.
Oh, yeah. And it keeps you going, especially in a system that doesn't always, or I should say very rarely, compensates you for the amount of work that you really do. Teachers teach because they love to teach. They do not do it for the money. I think that's well established now. And so to be able to get that kind of inspiration and that kind of feedback is just so important to keep them going.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to remember the story, but I was sitting in, you know, in one of our middle year schools programs in Vienna, and this child was telling me she's writing a book, and I forgot the title of her book. You know, it was something like the Need for Humanity or something, you know, very profound like that. And she said, but I'm very angry at the IB because they didn't give me enough time to finish this book. And I was like, you need a sabbatical, not a program.
Into your middle school. That's so funny. It's like, oh, but you have the rest of your life, off. So don't worry about that. That's so adorable.
Yeah, I know. And they are really, I mean, it's amazing stories, because I was in a school in Jordan, and this little young, you know, girl, I mean, you know, was showing me a program about, I can't remember, some animal she was researching. And this little boy came, was trying to tell me this girl's project, you know. And she kind of pushed him aside to say, hey, this is my project, and I'm going to tell her about my project, you know. And so it's the agency as well, right? She wasn't going to let this little boy steal the limelight from her. You know?
I love it. She was ready and able to face some of the issues she is definitely going to face within the workforce. So that's good to see.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's what we're about, you know, is to let the children own their learning, let the teachers be the encouraging adult, you know, not particularly know the answers or know the formula for education, and, you know, let the learning come alive in all of these classrooms around the world.
Mm-hmm. And so we've spoken about this primary years program for the littles, the middle years program for that kind of those bridge years leading up to high school, the diploma program really for that pre-college or pre-vocational preparation. But then you do have a fourth program now called the career-related program. How does that fit into the mix?
Well, this is our youngest program, really. And the reason we created it is because vocational education is becoming an important part of many, many systems. And I'm glad to see it's taking foot here in the USA as well, because it wasn't for a while. So essentially, we created this to say, you know, many students want to enter a profession right at the start, right? Or allied professions right after they finish high school. Mm-hmm. And so we would like to create a program to go alongside a pretty technical program that they're taking in school. So it's a, you know, two of our diploma courses. The student can take more, but the minimum is two. And then we also want them to have a project of where they are thinking, you know, a reflective project, and also where they're thinking about language and culture. So it's kind of like a small package of our a career program goes with their bigger study of vocations. And we've designed all our programs with schools and educators, and this was designed with some educators as well who said we need an alternative for students in our schools who don't want to do the full diploma but are really anxious to go into vocations. Mm-hmm. So that's why we designed that one.
That's really important too, because it is true that sometimes we lose sight of the fact that these sort of more quote unquote lofty educational goals, which are about thinking critically and about utilizing the scientific method and about having deep understanding of philosophy and humanity. Although those things, I think, are highly transferable because they can be applied to almost any profession, there are still some skilled positions, manualized positions, where even after an undergraduate degree, some students aren't well prepared for the realities of vocation. You know, they kind of have this arrested development, this sort of safety in the womb of the educational structure. You know, I've had friends who finished their PhDs and had no idea how to quote unquote adult.
It is true, though, because I think, you know, we now have so many highly technical fields where you do have to deeply study into that to get into a vocation right away, right? There could be mm-hmm. allied health professionals. There could be, you know, studying STEM fields and et cetera. And so I think that is a good pathway to go, especially when you don't have the money, say, to go to a full 4-year college or whatever. You know, your personal circumstances may not allow that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think this program is changing lives. Though I've been to schools where before these children didn't have any interest in higher education, etc. And you know, this is particularly we have a program that I visited recently in Kent, in the UK, and where we created this program in some schools. And the children there have been transformed, really. I'm, you know, just surprised at how much of a life effect it has had, where they didn't think they were capable of taking these highly rigorous courses. You know, mm-hmm. So when they took the two IB courses, they realized, oh, we can be challenged. I can do this. And they've actually moved away from thinking of vocational and going to the traditional bachelor's or whatever. I mean, that's not the reason it's designed, but it's pretty amazing to me how minds can be changed, right? And opportunities can be changed. So I think this program is going to be taking off quite well. It's just a fairly young program for us compared to the 50-year-old diploma, but it is taking off.
And don't you feel like so much of that has to do with role modeling, has to do with one-on-one interaction? You know, sometimes we grow up in these societal norms that reinforce to us over and over that is not the path that is available to us, that people who look like us or people with our means aren't the people that go into, you know, medicine or aren't the people that go into engineering or whatever. And it really does take having a really strong role model or seeing somebody who looks or acts or came from the same neighborhood as you did excelling or achieving in those areas before we even begin to think that it's a possibility for us. I didn't discover science until graduate school because as a young girl, I just did not think I would be good at it. I just didn't have enough people in my life telling me, oh yeah, you can totally be a scientist.
Yeah, that's very true, Kara. I mean, this is not my IB life, but when I was at at the university before my IB life, I spent a lot of my time working with the children, you know, or from low socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And one of the startling things for me was that role modeling, right? That being able to see yourself, in that position is so startling, because I did a program where we brought some, medical students of color. I asked them to wear their lab coats and brought them together with these children in high school. Mm-hmm. And just seeing this person in the lab coat saying, look, I didn't make great grades when I was in high school, but I'm able to do this now, and here's my path. That made such an impact. And to me, that's a bit of a shocker, really, because it wasn't a shock. It was an eye-opener, really. And I felt terrible because, here I was in the first world, right? And my children, had a father who, was a, doctor, et cetera, and had a scientific mind. So for them, the people they saw, it was a regular everyday occurrence, right? Mm-hmm. But I think our schools have to do more in bringing people like that into the classroom to say it's possible.
Yeah.
Because I think it makes such a world of difference, really,
Yeah, and bringing people like that from their own neighborhoods too, so they don't feel so distant. So they feel like, oh yeah, there's more than just what I see on my street or on my block. And there's more than just what I see within my family, because oftentimes these are, we see first generation students, first generation college students, kids who really are forging their own path because they don't have, not that they don't have incredibly supportive parents if they're lucky enough to have them, but they don't have parents who have been through those challenges.
Yeah. It's really interesting you say that, because I just came back from a conference. We had a conference in San Diego, so I was in your part of the world. Mm. And, what we're doing in our conferences is we have three of them in different parts of the world. This one is for our, this part of the world. And we bring in our alumni, and this alumni who talked at this last conference was talking about how hard it was to be Chinese and American at the same time. He was telling his story of his father having gone back to China pretty early on, and his mother raised him. And, he was struggling with everything. I mean, he's doing amazingly well now. But, he was just saying the IB program, because it allowed him to study Chinese and English, and he was in a public school at the same time, it allowed him to know that it was okay to be Chinese and okay to be American at the same time, and his struggle to, merge those two. And we heard from another alumnus, and she was, she was homeless, and she struggled through her diploma. So it's really amazing to see these stories. And I think that's why it's really a pleasure to be able to see the IB in public schools here in the United States. And I think that global connection that they feel, I'm not alone. I'm not just part of this world. I'm not just part of the U.S. I'm part of a movement that's much bigger. And this translates everywhere. There's a certain nicety to it, I think.
Oh, for sure. I'm definitely interested in your own personal perspectives, being, somebody who is both Indian and American, and somebody who has in many ways lived that life. And as you said, your own academic achievement has been very twisty and turny. So what brought you to the IB? How did that path go?
Yeah, so I think before the IB, I was in Rice University. And what I was doing is I was studying at that time I was doing both research and administration. And so in my grant writing part, the research part, I was trying to study what are the best programs of science education in the United States. Mm-hmm. This was around 2002. And there was a study that came out from the National Research Council called Learning and Understanding, in which they talked about both the Advanced Placement Program and the IB as being the two big stars in high STEM achievement. Because NSF, the National Science Foundation, was very concerned about STEM students. There weren't enough Americans graduating with STEM degrees. So this was a big concern at the time, and I think it remains a concern now, but I haven't been dabbling in research, so I can't say what the current stats are. So that's how I came to know the IB. And then I was already working with the AP programs, with the College Board programs. So I then created the teacher training programs for IB at the university. And that's how I came to know the IB.
Very cool. And so that was part of your, do you have a PhD or an EDD?
EDD.
Cool. So that's a doctorate of education.
Correct. Yeah.
So was that part of your EDD research, or were you already actively doing research as a career?
No, I was, this was after my doctorate. I came back to Rice and, joined, and I was doing my own research at that time. And that's how I came to know the IB. But I studied your, I read up on you and you talked about how you came to yours at a very funny path. The reason I decided to do an EDD was because at Rice, I was doing these very interesting, working with the internet way back when, in 1994. And we were playing with a lot of cutting edge distance learning technologies. And I thought, I don't know anything about this subject. I don't know education, because before that I didn't have educational training. And I thought, if I'm going to be doing these cutting edge things, I better, go understand what education is about and get some traditional education training, And I had, my son was 2 years old or 3 years old at the time. Yeah, 3 years old at the time. And so I thought, I'll go to try and get this. And Rice didn't have a education program, a doctorate in education. So I went to University of Houston and joined in just to think, well, I better learn something so I feel grounded in this, And then because I'm a little bit nuts, I started the program. And then I was like, I have to complete it. So that's how I got my doctorate, really, because I was just kind of curious to understand educational theories and all of that.
Oh, I love that. Kindred spirits.
Yeah. A little bit of craziness as well.
Oh, absolutely. You got to have that.
Yeah. So actually, my own doctoral studies were in higher education. My work was in higher education. But, through my experiences and, through my application was in K-12. So I've always felt this bridging, I always felt like I bridge things, cultures or disciplines. And so that was, I think, fun for me. I like kind of that spaces in between disciplines or between domains where fun stuff happens, right? Because when you're bridging, you have to be able to have that dialogue. You have to know what you want. You have to be grounded in your thinking, but you should be open enough to understand where the transferability is, I think. So that's kind of how I came to kind of into this position. And basically, because I was doing so much research, and I did, Rice was very kind to me. So I kind of did all I could there. And I studied the U.S. public education system and practiced in it, essentially, to, by doing programs and all. And I think for me, I was at that point trying to think, well, my children were, by the time I left my Rice, my children were grown. And I thought, well, I really want to understand how education works around the world, for some crazy reason. And so this kind of the thing at IB just happened. I started as a regional director in Singapore, because at that time, in 2009, Singapore and the East was emerging as this educational place. Everyone was talking about Singapore and Finland as the two places. So I was kind of curious, and I started there, and I didn't expect to stay, to do all of this or to have these positions. It just kind of all happened, really. I always focus on what to do well now. I don't think of what's next. So it just kind of happened.
I feel like when people ask me for advice about their educational planning or their careers, or, the job, you have a job that I would love to have, and how do you go about it, and what should I do, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's very hard to make a sort of prescription for how to get to the end place. You can set goals for yourself, but like we've talked about so much about flexibility and being nimble, the number one thing I always tell people is don't be afraid to walk through an open door, even if it takes you on a turn to the left or to the right, because sometimes that's how you get to these really incredible places. Sometimes when you're so focused on the straight and narrow path and doing everything exactly how you thought you were supposed to do it, it actually closes off opportunities.
Yeah, and also try not to think of a job as a job, right? I mean, I always thought of things as, you know, this is, I'm here to do something and I'll get that stuff done, but I want more. I want to learn more. I want to be given more. I want to ask questions and I want to, you know, do different kinds of things, right? So I think, you know, also, like you said, you know, to find the open door, you have to be open yourself, right? Mm. And then have the energy to walk through that door, knowing it might not yield success.
Yeah, and that the things that you'll learn while trying it, and even if it has some failures along the way, are in and of themselves tools. You know, they will lead to better outcomes, because sometimes if you never fail, the first time it happens, you are not prepared. You see that a lot with high achieving kids and high achieving university programs. And that's where a lot of mental health issues come to play, because they've never failed and they don't know what to do with being overwhelmed or what to do with having a failing test grade or something. And just the amount of heaviness that they bring upon themselves when you just kind of sometimes want to shake them and be like, it's really not the end of the world. I promise, you know.
Especially not for some of them, right? Because you can, if they just get over that hump, they'll be fine.
Oh, absolutely. And you're going to do it a million more times in your life. You're going to be like, whoops, totally missed that deadline. You know, it's going to happen. And we've got to be resilient. It's so important.
Good. Yes. I think this is why part of the reason I'm, you know, such a fan of the IB, yes, I'm getting paid and all of that, but is the application is so important. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just learning and writing for exams, right? I think as long as students keep in mind that application of that knowledge to real problems is so important, and developing your own strength is quite important. You know, we talked about my movement and we talked about your movement. This is, you have to develop an anchor in all of this, whether it's this, you know, tsunami of information that hits you, or the number of apps that hit you, or whatever, you have to, that self-regulation, I think, is quite important to be taught from the start.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is such important feedback for all of us, whether we're still in school or we're lifelong learners. Siva, I mean, I have to thank you for joining me today. I've already kept you for an entire hour. I was hoping that I could steal just a couple more minutes to close out the episode by asking you the same final questions that I ask all of my guests on the show. Would you be amenable to that?
Sure.
Excellent. So I want you to think about the future, and I want you to think about it in whatever context comes up for you right now. It could be personal, it could be professional, it could be global. It sounds to me like many of those things cross over in your life. So when you think about the future, number one, I want to know from you, especially with your unique perspective, what is kind of the thing that keeps you up the most at night? What are, you know, what is that goal or that unachieved problem, that unsolved problem that you struggle with, and that maybe sometimes you get a little pessimistic about, you know, that thing that's weighing on you. But on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely optimistic about, you know, where you're not playing lip service, but you really do think that we're headed in the right direction?
Okay, great. I am obsessing about something right now, and that is, I think, the stuff that's really bothering me right now is the role of my profession, the K-12 educators, in educating students about what's happening with the social media and all of that, you know. Mm-hmm. So I am quite worried that children and parents are not being educated about the engagement with the devices, you know, right from the start, and not understanding the swipes, you know, the algorithms behind the swipes, what is being asked of you, how much time you're giving, how much it's pulling you in, and therefore the lack of, you know, cortical activity and the lack of kind of the ability to focus and all of that kind of stuff. That is quite important, and not just for learning, but for becoming a human being. I think that stuff is worrying me quite a lot. I've been talking about it to our principals and heads of schools to say what's happening in schools. And I think we missed a beat in not educating our educators about all of this stuff, you know, because you know now see how much you're programmed to kind of hit that swipe button and all of that. And I think if educated, it should be a responsibility to educate our children and our parents about all that is going on. Because sometimes I've seen, you know, these devices being used as babysitters or being said, you know, that, well, the children are learning something, et cetera. But that tactile need to touch and to learn and to engage and to talk and all of this, I think it's a new world. I'm not intimidated by it because I engaged with it. I loved it. I adopted it. It's part of my research, et cetera. So it's not an intimidating world. I think it's just that people need to understand what's happening behind the scenes.
Mm.
And also how to be like media literate when they are interacting with our entire news feed or our entire informational infrastructure online. You know, how do you filter the good from the bad? How do you make these kinds of critical decisions when it used to be you go to the library and you look in the card catalog and you just kind of trust that these things are vetted and you can't do that anymore.
But those things were vetted. I mean, that's why we had librarians and they would curate the collections and they would, whether we agreed with it or not, they would say these books are okay and these books are not okay. So there was, you know, there was that filtration happening for our children. And I think for me now, it's just, you know, it's just not knowing and, you know, the immediacy as well, the kind of how much of the mind share is going into these apps, et cetera, I think are worrisome for me. But I think there's the possibility of educating though. And I think, I have this positive outlook on life and the world that it balances itself out in the end. So I'm sure if we keep at it and keep educating our parents and children, I think that they will know. And they will understand. And I've certainly, you know, when I'm invited to graduation talks, et cetera, speak about this quite openly to say, think of what you're missing out when you're looking at that device all the time or when it's trapping you, right?
Sure. Yeah, be empowered, you know, to use it as a tool, but to not be used by it.
Yeah. So to answer your second question, what I'm genuinely optimistic about also has to do with technology. I think what I'm really excited about these days is I'm seeing some young entrepreneurs engaging AI in education, artificial intelligence in education, in ways that I haven't seen before. So not the transactional stuff, but truly thinking about how is this child's brain learning, right? And you know, through big data and all of that, understanding how learning is happening and not unidimensional learning, i.e. like, you know, if I'm studying physics, let me give you another physics problem, et cetera. So not automated, paths or playlists and all of that, which are all good and well. But what I'm seeing is people who are experimenting with being able to use a number of variables like, you know, engagement with the material, persistence through the material, and all of that, and creating a learning engine that is able to do both, is able to remediate where the child needs more content, but also accelerate when the child, you know, is able to progress further. And I think those give me great hope, because there's a lot of children in this world who don't have good teachers, you know, unfortunately for them. And so I think for me that those kind of, if we can create those kind of content areas so that, you know, any child anywhere can get access to a good education, that would be, I think, pretty amazing to me, you know. So I'm quite optimistic about where that's all going and the few people who are experimenting and where we can help in the IB to make that experiment better or deeper. I think we'll be engaging with those kind of new ideas and new ideations, you know.
Wonderful. I have to say I share in that optimism. Well, Siva, thank you so much for joining me. Before you go, let us know, where can people, you know, read about your work? Maybe, I don't know if you are on social media interacting or definitely about the International Baccalaureate, where can they go to learn more?
Well, I definitely have a Twitter feed, and I'm active on my LinkedIn feed most of the time, although I haven't been active there for a while. Mm-hmm. So I think both of those are sources to know about me. And the work of the IB is on our IBO website. It's ibo.org.
Great, great. And I will link to that in the notes of the show. Siva, thank you so much for joining me. It was really illuminating and so much fun.
No, thank you, Kara. It has been fun. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.